Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hola, socios. Hola, equipo. My name is Neil.
I'm Liam.
This is John Nurnberger from Kansas City, Missouri, USA.
Moray Field near Brisbane in Queensland.
Edinburgh.
Barcelona.
And I'm a socio.
I'm a socio.
I am a socio of The Big Interview.
Hi, my name's Neil. I'm a socio of The Big Interview from Moray Field near Brisbane in Queensland. My favourite episode of the last season was the one with Sir Les Ferdinand. I never realised that he'd actually played in Turkey at the start of his career. Every time I listen to an episode, I always learn something new. Keep up the good work. Thanks.
Hello, I'm Neil White, and this is The Big Interview at the World Cup. In Krasnodar, Russia, we have Graham Hunter. Graham, first of all, thanks for sending the last podcast in at, I think, 4 a.m. local time after your late night flight back from Sochi and Portugal 3, Spain 3. You fly with the Spain team on those trips. What was the mood like on the way back from that one?
Yeah, in many ways it was surprisingly good. I didn't for a second, after the way that they played, think that there would be, you know, long faces or silence. But they're, you know, a really brutally competitive bunch, because you already know, all the socios know, talent's not enough. And therefore, I thought there'd be a great deal more frustration, given the fact that they'd lost that late goal to Cristiano Ronaldo. It was so avoidable, given that it was probably a tackle that Gerard Pique would admit he didn't have to make. And therefore, and what's more than that, I can't remember what I communicated at 4 a.m. the other morning, but it needs repeating that Sochi was extremely humid. The stadium, which is a joy to be around, is right on the sea. The temperature was high, and therefore anybody who's been in that situation will know that it's ultra humid. And because Spain kept the ball really quite well, I think we'd all admit that, whether it was, you know, the golden days of Xavi and Xavi Alonso, nonetheless, they made Portugal work, but they still put in a huge shift themselves, and that meant, without any question whatsoever, that they were drained at the end. And the two players who were picked for anti-doping, which is just a regular thing, found it hard to produce, being as dehydrated as they were. So there was a long, long wait, and the idea of being a home, Krasnodar being home, by I think the idea was that they were to be home by about 12:45, 1 in the morning. Well, you know, that went away completely, and the plane taking them home, it's just little strange things. The plane taking them home was delayed on takeoff at Sochi, probably because they'd broken schedule by not getting to out of the stadium to the airport in time. And that meant that there was, you know, a little bit of a wait on the tarmac, and that was because of the amount of traffic. And you'd have thought at that time in the morning it couldn't be so. And then on arrival at Krasnodar, at whatever time in the morning, 3 a.m, it was really, really busy. You know, the airport was absolutely jumping, and it's not a big place. So that whole delay idea just bounced off them like water off a duck's back. And on the plane, the mood was, there was a lot of smiles, there was a lot of players chitter-chattering amongst themselves, playing sort of shared games, whether it was cards or some of them play a game I can only compare to sort of, I'm sure there was a childhood game that I saw called Ludo, and it looks something like that, but on a very large style iPad. And there was, I'm certain that I did report last time at 4 a.m, that because Dr. Cotto had his birthday, there was a rousing round of cumpleaños feliz, which all the players joined in and then applauded him. And he was really touched, and he was reminding me that the sort of last World Cup that, that can't be right, the last World Cup, but he said, look, the last time that it was a match day on this date was against Switzerland, and he said that was a horrible way to celebrate my birthday. And as you would all imagine, I made the joke about, oh, so it's the same date every year. And he says, it's often the case for a birthday. So that may not have been dazzling humour, but we were smiles and enjoyment.
It's not bad for 3 a.m.
And it was okay. And you know, it's the kind of rubbish that you talk to people that you're not really allowed to get into. So anyway, medically, how are the team? So the whole experience was fine. And I suppose what I'm trying to, in painting little brush strokes, what I'm trying to get across is that they seemed to be buzzing on an adrenaline of we played well. I think that's absolutely the case. And if you asked me about the flight home, if you amalgamate what they said in the stadium and how they behaved in the flight home, it was like there was no demoralisation that Ronaldo had got the 3-3, no demoralisation that David De Gea had made a clear error, a really clear error. And if I could sum up the atmosphere, which is what I think you're getting at, in terms of do they think that they took a bigger step than 1 point towards qualifying from the group, then the answer is yes.
I think that's key. Before we started these podcasts, you had tipped up Spain as a potential winner. And looking at that game, that's what stood out. Ronaldo does his thing. You know, there's a kind of like a story behind each of those three goals that Spain can tell themselves to kind of make those goals okay for them in the long term. But just the way that Spain played for patches of that game were, they must have been incredibly encouraging for Hierro and for those players.
Yeah, I do think so, because, you know, if you want to draw further conclusions, nobody can really expect me to remember precisely what I've said in each podcast. And therefore, again, I disclaim knowledge of whether I've said there were moments in the training where, in training like, there's been nobody who looks out of place, which is, for example, I've seen that before in 2014, where, you know, much as I really absolutely adore Casillas as somebody who's influenced my life, my career, but also as somebody with whom I still talk privately. But in 2014, with each training session, you could see that he should have been dropped. I've never seen an elite player perform like that in training and keep his place, ever. And therefore, that might be a stark comparison, but nonetheless, if I try to represent what I've seen in training so far here in Krasnodar, there's been absolutely nothing close to that whatsoever. But the drop-off of, you know, the tungsten tough and cutting-edge sharpness you need to win the Europa League for Atleti, or, you know, win the FA Cup for Chelsea, or win the league and so on for Barca, win the European Cup for Real Madrid. There are others I could name. That level of readiness and sharpness takes a natural drop-off once you give players a pause. You want to give them a pause because you're asking them to dig deep again in terms of their mental and physical preparation for the World Cup that lies ahead. But you're sort of calibrating at a risk of the minor drop-off of match readiness. And therefore, we saw it in the friendly that we talked about at the Madrigal against Switzerland, and then in Krasnodar against Tunisia, you saw just not quite at it. And in training, for example, the point I'm trying to make at length is that Isco's been fine, but let me tell you, in training, he didn't look like he did against Portugal. And maybe even if you take the industry of Koke, even if you take the greater sharpness, and I thought game control by Iniesta and Busquets in the period when Spain were losing 1-0 to the period where just before Cristiano scored his second goal, it looks like Spain are significantly ahead. It might not be that Busquets and Iniesta stand out as men of the match for Spain. But in that period when they needed to turn things back around, I thought that they did. And Silva's sharpness, Alba's sharpness, we could go through several of them and give them plaudits. But it's clear that Isco's rhythm and Isco's sort of ability to go past people, his dictation of match tempo, his chance creation, that beautiful thumping shot off the bar, all of these stood out as being a level above where he'd been training. And who doesn't? I mean, we can now talk about any club side that we, you know, each of us individually love, or a national side that we like watching. And the big players, you know, when the gong rings, the big players come up for dinner. And that's what I thought Isco did. But there was another candidate. I genuinely thought that if you take Nacho's unfortunate moment with Ronaldo, where the penalty is conceded, where, you know, I'm still not 100% convinced. I thought his game was very, very good. I thought that his ability to link up with midfield, to give them an out ball, his ability to go past players, his aggression on the ball, his pace, and his mentality too, given that, you know, we have to point out that at club level, he's a guy who's got to consider himself player number 12 or player number 13. And to be like that for your club, and albeit that you play a lot, you win a lot, to be player 12 or 13 and to be ready for your international team, to me, is a standout. And maybe because of the Salah incident, not everybody remembers this little sort of seesaw game that's going on, and that when Carvajal breaks down and is sobbing on the turf in Kiev, you know, it's Nacho needs to come on and have a game and help Real Madrid win. And now it's Nacho, as it was in Sochi the other day, kind of looking over his shoulder at his teammate, Dani Carvajal, who as he was coming onto the pitch the other day, you know, a couple of days ago, let's call it maybe the last training session in Krasnodar before flying to Sochi. Because it's hot, he lifts up his shirt as he walks onto the training pitch to sort of wipe his face of sweat or whatever. And you know, he's built like, you know, the greatest sort of light middleweight boxer that you could imagine. He's absolutely ripped around his, you know, his abdomen, looking, you know, with the exception of having to build back his sharpness after a few weeks out, he's looking just absolutely ready to roll. Nacho has to take that into context. Imagine before the game against Portugal that, you know, his tendency at right back is going to be very short. And immediately that he concedes that penalty, he must be thinking, flipping heck, that's, you know, that's all the boss needs to put Dani Carvajal in against Iran. And then he goes out and doesn't only score that fabulous goal. And I'm certain I used the comment that when we were filming the green screen, I said, listen, you, as well as doing the step forward that you see on the TV or on the giant screens, do a little funky, funny celebration, because that will get used by our boss, our TV bosses. He's like, nah, I'm not doing that. I don't score. Well, there you go. So that's why, Neil, I'm picking on Nacho for praise above and beyond the beauty of that goal.
Yeah, let's stay with him. I mean, you got all your calls right in terms of Hierro's first selection as Spain manager. You thought he would go with Diego Costa up front. You thought that was his man. It turned out to be the case. You said Koke, not Thiago, in midfield. That's what happened. And you said Nacho and not Odriozola, even though Odriozola had started the last warm-up game against Tunisia in Krasnodar before the soap opera began. That doesn't happen. Does Nacho even start that game against Portugal?
I don't know for sure. I'll tell you what I did see. This is what, you know, when you guys made me publish books or when we began podcasts, I'll often talk to people about why I came to Spain. I guess it possibly sounds stupid, but one of the things that made me want to come to Spain was that you get to go to training. So in training, even though I was very surprised that Nacho didn't start against Tunisia, because that seemed 100% obvious to me in terms of what type of rival Portugal were going to be, the level of experience that Nacho's got, and the lack of experience that Odriozola, a great kid, a flyer, on somebody who's clearly got not just daring but technical ability. I just thought, well, it's clear that Nacho has to start. And then the two things that added up to me saying that to you were number one, the fact that when Nacho came on against Tunisia, he made, you know, a palpable difference in decision making, pace of the ball being moved, sporting aggression. It was a standout. And secondly, there was a moment actually on the day before Lopetegui sacked, i.e. the day that the news comes out, there was a moment where and it was interesting about Lopetegui. He was a guy, really was a guy for individual tuition. So in the training sessions we've seen here in Krasnodar, Lopetegui, I've seen taking Ramos aside and giving him a long set of instructions. I've seen him taking Piqué aside and doing that, and I saw him doing that to Nacho. And what it looked absolutely clear was him saying, this is what I want from you. Here are my requirements about position, about when you run, when you break, when you don't. This is what I want you to do in terms of looking inside to you, to your left, to see where, for example, Ramos is, or, you know, whether it's, let's say, Koke is positionally, what your responsibilities are vis-a-vis the people around you. So to me, even though there was a change and Yero took over, it struck me that Nacho had to start. And what transpired subsequently, because I've spoken to Nacho twice post-game, was that he really enjoyed a single year that Yero was involved as an assistant coach at Real Madrid. And he, you know, Nacho was born in Madrid, so he's a madrileño and he's a madridista. And for him, like, it's just a fluke, but his very talented brother, younger brother, Alex, who I genuinely thought might be the one that made the more progress of the two, that, you know, there may be a sort of Gary Neville, Phil Neville thing going on here, in that Phil Neville was always the one that, you know, Manchester United, not just Manchester United, Sir Alex Ferguson said was more talented sportsman. And while Phil Neville's career was terrific, Gary's was better, and there was a level of edge, a level of desire that probably separated the two of them. Maybe that's the case between Nacho and Alex. I can't be 100% sure. But Alex is very, very talented and stood out as a junior Spain player. And the two of them made their debuts on the same day for Real Madrid. But, you know, Nacho, the reason I bring Alex up is that he gave an interview several months ago saying, you know, I think that my brother is talented enough to go on and mark an era in the way that Sanchez did, the way that Hierro did at Real Madrid. Now, these are big names to be banding around. And in some instances, they'd be injudicious names to be banding around. Yeah, although Nacho is not a starter player like Sanchez and Hierro were throughout their careers, he's got three Champions League medals. I think he's a fabulous footballer. You know, I'd instantly reach for him. If I had a transfer budget and I was in charge of another team, I would instantly say, yeah, I'm having him now, and he's in my starting 11. So it all bundled together quite nicely from a storytelling point of view, because he's been, Nacho has been a guy who's tried to take advantage of his disadvantage in that at 12, already a Real Madrid starlet. He was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes and told by a doctor, instantly the diagnosis came through, that he would have to give up football. And he called that the worst weekend of his life, because it had seemed to them, number one, there had been the usual causes that made the family examine what was wrong. And to then be immediately told, you've got to give up football, was devastating for a 12-year-old with talent. And what his father and mother did for him, his mother had always driven him, you know, quite a distance to training as a kid, put in a lot of effort, and his father is still his representative now. So that's a beautiful story in terms of how a family can pull together to get the two kids the professional careers that they merit. They just immediately said, well, second opinion. And the second opinion was with a doctor that he's stayed with since. And, you know, Nacho explained to me that the difference was night and day, because the second doctor, only 3 days later, said, that's absolutely rubbish. That's the opposite. Sport is now even more important to you. This, once you have to learn to live with diabetes and learn how to balance your diet, the idea of being physically fit and using your talent is still more central. And you must, Nat just used the word to me, like, then the second doctor made it an obligation that he fulfilled his professional abilities. And therefore, without being too mawkish, from that weekend to this, which was scoring his first ever international goal, in a situation where Spain were, you know, had been losing to the European champions, and he scored the goal of the game. In fact, you know, so far, I still think it's goal of the tournament, so far, was, you know, if you're a storyteller, those kind of ups and downs are marvellous to be able to explain to people. And I use the word turning his disadvantage to an advantage, because he actively wants kids around the world who see him scoring a goal like that, or see him scoring, pardon me, lifting the Champions League trophy, to say, well, if I have diabetes, or if I have a problem, a medical problem that's of similar importance, I too can overcome it, and I can triumph. And he actively said, you know, I want to be an example for them. Therefore, the goal, you know, can be measured in importance to a greater degree than the impact it had on Spain-Portugal.
When you look at his progression at Madrid, I mean, he really does make sort of baby steps season to season in terms of his game time and the impact he's having on the team. But there is something emblematic about having one of your own coming through the ranks and staying there, even if it is as number 12, as you said. Has there been any point in that development where that didn't seem likely? Has there been any one of the carousel of Madrid managers who looked to loan him out or maybe transfer him out of the club?
I don't think so. The idea that, for example, he can play at right-back, left-back, centre-back, that he's a dyed-in-the-wool supporter of the club, that he's come through the ranks from 12 to, I think he's 27 now, tells you that, and also I'd throw in the fact that, as I pointed out before, he's a really good footballer. He brings an attacking menace. He's quick in terms of his discipline, in terms of his physical regimen. He's what any manager would ask for, and therefore, no, that there's not a point at which, in fact, it's been a harmony thing. He's never wanted to go. If you look at how his numbers grow, it's been testament to the fact that he's, as much as he would obviously choose to be a regular, and may even think he's a better right-back than Danny Carvajal, I don't know, there's a level of satisfaction with where he's at. They renewed his contract. It's still got some years to run. I think we're talking about a very content man, who is obviously going to compete to be a quicker choice for managers than the multi-million pound players that they can sign. But I think he's fully, fully aware that it'll be a strange day when Madrid don't need somebody who can play four different positions. And while his height means that he's not a natural centre-back, his fierceness, his competitiveness, his pace into the tackle, his tackling ability are the type of things that are invaluable for a club. And you're right, I accept your point that Madrid don't necessarily put home bred first. But if you look at, you know, a guy that I so often find constructively critical things to say about Florentino Perez, it's also true that over the last few years, he has wanted to have more Spaniards in his team, first of all, and then more... La Fabrica is what, you know, the equivalent of La Masia. Homebred players. I don't know if you can count Asensio, but the idea of buying him first before Barcelona and then loaning him out and taking him back. Lucas, another guy brought through the ranks, loaned out, taken back. Casemiro, bought quite young, loaned out to Lopetegui at Porto, and brought back. We can say the same of one or two players, including Carvajal, who went to the Bundesliga. Nacho fits in that profile, Neil, of guys that they're like, either you can identify their progress at Madrid or they've been there for a long time, and therefore he fits in the current era too. And I think that Well, I don't think. I can tell you that while Zidane's been in charge and while Real Madrid have been conquering Europe and while they've been largely until this season running Barca close or defeating them in the league the season before, I've really enjoyed the profile of their football, the profile of their people. And in meeting them and talking to them, I like all these individuals. You know, it is a fact, certainly from my point of view, that Lucas, for example, and Isco, and certainly Nacho, are really decent people to be around, fun to talk to, friendly, respectful, and in no way behaving like superstar, multimillionaire, multiple Champions League winning footballers.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, more Spain, a little bit of Portugal, and some Atleti.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Welcome back. First of all, Graham, we've seen Portugal 3, Spain 3 through a Spanish prism. Did you see any of Portugal after the game, in particular Mr. Cristiano Ronaldo? Did you get a sense at all of the reaction and the mood from them after that draw in the first match?
Well, first of all, I want to know how you managed to get into a Spanish prison before I did, because the odds on that are very, very long. This is something that I don't want too much publicity for, so people, please don't tweet this, but I saw more than I actually wanted to of Cristiano Ronaldo, because by nature our work is backstage. I often use the word backstage because I grew up watching my dad managing Scotland the Watt, and therefore I spent a lot of time in theatres and backstage in theatres, and therefore the tunnels around a stadium I think merit that description to me. And as we were leaving, it just so happened to get on the convoy to go with the Spain players to the airport. We happened to be walking past the Portugal dressing room. And the kit man of Portugal barged out carrying a big box, because they are the worker ants of post-match. Any of the multiple kit men are working their butts off. In any situation, any club or international thing, about get the kit together, make sure it's all there, make sure it's on the team bus. Don't be the ones that are holding the players up. So he barges out of the dressing room and leaves the door open just by fluke as we're walking by. And I'm not going to go into any more detail other than I definitely saw far more than I wanted to.
Okay, let's move on. Let's talk Diego Costa. I don't know how much of Diego you saw, but it looked like that was his biggest night in a Spain shirt so far. Fair?
Not only are you right, it's by a huge distance his most important. I think he scored, I mean, listen, pull me down if I'm wrong, but I think he might have scored the last nine starts now for Spain. And I think that irrespective of the fact that when Spain played the World Champions as a warm-up game, Rodrigo started and scored, I think Diego Costa has begun to believe in himself as a Spain player, has begun to feel a lot more comfortable. I think that under Lopetegui, and then still more so in the single game under Hierro, players around him have begun to find a way to play the combination possession football that Iniesta and Silva, who had a super game, I thought, and Jordi Alba and Busquets like, but still be able to service Diego Costa in the way that he wants, which is the Atleti way, where the ball is given to him much more quickly in situations where there's a percentage idea that the defenders may be caught out. So, for example, and because I didn't have replay facilities at the game and watched it like a fan would watch and have not to this day seen the game back on TV, it was you that needed to emphasise to me that it was Busquets' long ball to Diego Costa for him to pull the central defenders of Portugal around in a way that he can only do when he's confident and physically fit. So I think that the second goal, you know, I'm wary of going overboard about Diego Costa because I think the second goal was the kind of goal, I don't mean the finish because it's on a plate for him, but it's the kind of goal whereby as long as you make the right run, the cleverness is in the use of the free kick, the back post header, and at that point anybody who's there can score it. It happens to be Costa. But he did other things, I think, whereby it showed a level of self-belief and confidence that bode well for Spain, particularly if the service is kind of, I don't know, there's a word in English that I'm struggling for because I've been spending the last couple of weeks speaking in Spanish, but it's like they've found a way to do two things at once and that there's a sort of alternating gear between hold the ball, hold the ball, hold the ball, give it now. Whereas in the times when that decision about give it now was belonged to, say, Xavi or Cesc even, there was a Barca element to the release of the ball, which was only at the right time, not when the striker wants it. There's a lot more now of give it to Costa when he wants it. Now, I thought that, I still think that Iago Aspas, in training and when he came on, gave inklings. Like, for example, there was a... Okay, it wasn't a fierce shot, but Aspas got a shot on target, which I think stemmed off a 26-pass move in that last chunk of the game, when admittedly Portugal equalised. And I think there was another stage in the match where Barca kept the ball for about 2 minutes. Pardon me. That was a definite Freudian slip. Spain kept the ball for 2 minutes, which, you know, I continue to think is pretty remarkable at international level. I continue to think that it will cost a lot of teams that running around and then tiring in the late stages of games that can be to Spain's huge benefit. And I continue to think that when you look at this team as being without Xabi Alonso, without Cesc, without Xavi Hernandez, and with Iniesta at a different stage of his career, an extended stage of his career, that's a remarkable thing to be able to do in that humidity. So Costa interests me a lot, and indeed when training comes on, there's no point in mucking about. We're recording this pre-Spain training on Sunday afternoon. So as much as we get of training, Costa will be in my crosshairs to see what is his mood, what is his movement, is the galvanising effect of having scored twice with his first two shots on target in a World Cup, which tells you about his Brazil experience. You know, how has that helped him? How has that helped people around him trust him? Coque the other day was saying, look, I've adapted well between the style of Diego Simeone and the style of Spain, but so has Costa. And his words were proven true.
Okay, I hope we have enough time for one more subject of conversation.
We do.
Good. And I don't know how much of a LeBron James fan you are, but do you remember King James trailing his decision to leave Cleveland?
I remember him hiding up the tree to get away from the roundheads, if I'm not mistaken.
Different King James. Similar dilemma. He was split between two teams as well, but ended up joining Miami in a sort of drawn-out reality TV spectacle that was known as The Decision. While you've been away, Antoine Griezmann did his own version, imaginatively called La Decision, as he decided between, well, how strong were the smoke signals saying that he was going to be a Barcelona player next season at the height of that news story?
One of the things I've tried to transmit in all the work we've done, whether written or recorded, is that both in terms of what we call the Madrid media and the Barca media, you have to use not a lie detector, but you have to use a sort of water diviner to see whether what you're getting is a trickle or a river. Because a lot of them, not all of them, but the majority of them exist on briefings. And therefore, the briefings were ultra strong, that Griezmann had already decided to join Barcelona, that the price would be a little over the 100 million buyout clause, which he has as of July 1st. As we speak, it's 200 million, but it just drops by contractual agreement on July the 1st. And therefore, had you come either new or naive to the situation, you were reading the Catalan paper, you would take it as an absolute fact that Griezmann had made an irrevocable decision to join Barca. And I think that Bartomeu, the Barca president, thought that was true. It is long established and a cause of discussion between the two clubs that Barca spoke to Griezmann's representative. And it turns out that, I know what you're angling at, is that one of the companies that is that has Gerard Piqué as its owner made that video film about Griezmann's decision. Now, that has resulted in heated stories about Barca are furious with Piqué, and Gerard confronted the situation on Friday night, whatever the night was, the game, Friday night, and said, look, Griezmann and I spoke about this a long time ago and said, once you make your decision, it's up to you what you do, but if you're wanting to announce it in a particular way, then we'll make the film and we'll provide you with the resources. So it wasn't like Piqué was guiding him on his decision or participating in humiliating the Barca board deliberately. He's just a guy who wants to be involved in multimedia projects, multi-commercial projects. So, for example, his involvement with the Players' Tribune is gigantic, and it occupies a lot of his time. He's in Barca time. He's flown off to interview Neymar, to interview Gigi Buffon, both of which are interesting products, with Piqué conducting the interviews. Above and beyond that, I knew for many, many months that he was speaking to Nadal and Djokovic and Andy Murray in particular and saying to them, well, do you feel properly rewarded by the Davis Cup? Do you think that you get the treatment that you merit? And the large part of their response was no. So between them, and including Mkhitaryan, the owner, his friend of some years, and the owner of Rakuten, being the key investor, Gerard Piqué has reshaped tennis and has got ATP approval to have what effectively, I think, from what I can understand, looks like it's going to be a World Cup of tennis sort of thing. Now, it's my point of view, and I've never spoken to Gerard about this, and certainly about the Griezmann video, but I have spoken to him about his need to remain engaged with. I think what I'm trying to say is that even playing at the elite level of football doesn't keep him totally engaged. He's a very restless, both intellectual capacity and commercial capacity. And you can see that from his financial well-being, he's not doing this for pure profit. He's doing it because he has the capacity. Now, he did admit the fact that Bartomeu phoned him to say, well, what the heck? And he explained it sufficiently to Bartomeu that this was a product of a new way of thinking, that I am commercially and in multimedia terms involved in projects beyond my contract with Barcelona, and I feel that that's entirely legitimate. And on that point, I completely back him. And I think if there's heat in this situation, not Miami Heat, I think there is a clear piece of evidence that Barcelona thought they had the deal sealed when it wasn't. I think there's a clear piece of evidence that Griezmann's relationship with Simeone, Griezmann's relationship with the Atleti concept, by which I mean the fans, the board, the fellow players, was much stronger than Bartomeu imagined. And I think that, as can often happen in football, there was too long between the point at which Barca thought they had a "yes, I'm committed" from Griezmann and the point at which the July 1st clause dropped. And therefore, they couldn't get it over the line until then. And that time includes Fernando Torres leaving. That time includes Griezmann having a better idea about who's potentially joining Atleti, i.e. Lamar. That time includes Griezmann scoring twice in the Europa League final and changing, again, his profile at the club, lifting a major trophy. All of these things influenced the deal. And the fact that Gerard Piqué's company filmed it, you know, to me, doesn't matter a flying fuck. And you know, there's a lot of rubbish spoken in public about the players that we yearn to watch on TV, the players who make your career, my career, more interesting. And it doesn't mean that people that we like or admire are necessarily blameless all the time. That would be ridiculous. But in this instance, the nub of the story is Barca thought they had Griezmann. They didn't. They publicised it too loudly to the Catalan media, and they've got egg on their chin. That's just, there you go. It's that simple.
Is there another side to look at if we focus exclusively on the Atleti angle? Is this a change of gear here? Can you remember another time when they've had a player in demand at such an elite level and they've managed to say no? I mean, you mentioned Lamar's imminent arrival. They've got the new stadium now, revenue-generating machine. Is this a statement of intent? Have they changed gears?
Yeah, it's a patent statement of intent in that by a long way he's going to be the most, or have the most lucrative contract of any Atleti player in history. And there's another clear factor needs to be brought into play. They host the Champions League final next June. Now, given the way that they played this season, you can see that they were on the cusp. They didn't have enough in the Champions League qualifying group. But once they went out, they did what they've done repeatedly since, I think, 2010, which is win the Europa League. Now, I think that if they allow Griezmann to go, then other players begin to think, well, is this the right place to be? Simeone begins to think, well, there are chances, there are many, many chances for me to go to the Premier League. It was the case that Chelsea were trying very, very hard with him. Inter will sooner or later say, this is the time, this is the same moment as the moment when Atleti said yes to you and we now need you. So the Griezmann decision is, as you're hinting at, multi-layered. They, I think, legitimately want to aim at being in the Champions League final in their own stadium, although that's a poison chalice, as Bayern Munich, for example, could tell you. And I think that they understand that while Barca are, I think you can clearly argue that Barca are in a state of, if not upheaval, a state of flux. Luis Suarez is not scoring the same number of goals against quality opposition. Leo Messi is going to be coming back off the, you know, the umpteenth summer tournament of his recent career. There's no Xavi. Iniesta has left. It's legitimate to say that Barcelona are in need of really intelligent. They've reshaped their buying department this summer already with the introduction of Eric Abidal and the losing of Robert, their current director of football. Real Madrid have looked eminently powerful in Europe but were hugely off the pace domestically. Zidane is gone. There are, you know, there are again clear needs at Real Madrid, and is it a guarantee that they're going to walk away with the domestic title or the Champions League again next season? No. So if you're the decision maker at Socios, or if Neil, if you're the decision maker at Atletico Madrid, then you know that the best thing you can do, so long as he's hungry, is keep your existing talent. If Griezmann is sated by the big new deal, which, knowing him, watching him, listening to him, knowing people around him, the answer to that is no. But once you've made that judgment, does Griezmann get a little bit lazy or complacent because of the new deal and because he stayed? If you say, well, no to that, then you keep him. You fight like a tiger to keep him. And you get all the positive ripple in the pond effect off the back of that, and that's what they've done. And I commend them. And personally, I'm delighted. Really, it keeps, you know, the third force in Spanish football much more interesting, much more competitive. It allows them to be a magnet for drawing other players, I'm sure. The debt situation is something that I'm not quite sure how they... there's a test for them, and it may be that there are others need to be sold because of it. But if they keep Oblak, and now that they've kept Griezmann, the absolute fundamental is they're saying to their fans, to their fellow, to the current squad, to the media, to the world, we're still competitive, we're still hungry, and we want to grow. And that's to me, that's ultra positive.
Okay, that's our show. Thank you, Graham. More soon. Spain take on group topping Iran on Wednesday evening in Kazan. In the meantime, here's a few ways for you to support the podcast. Number one, leave a review on iTunes. Number two, if you're the shaving kind, go to trygillette.com/biginterview and save £4 on your blades. Number three, join our supporters trust. Become a socio. Go to patreon.com/GrahamHunter. Speaking of whom, until next time, thank you, sir, and dasvidaniya.
Thanks for being there for us. This wouldn't have a worth without you. Some of you have been feeding back and saying that you've been enjoying it. Support us. Join us, please. Keep us going. I really hope you're enjoying these World Cup shows. We've got huge plans for next season, but we do need your help to make them happen. Go to patreon.com/GrahamHunter right now to become a socio, a member, to join us, to support us. You'll get an extra big interview every month, plus lots of other bonus content. Last season, our members got 9 exclusive big interviews, including Rafa van der Vaart, Troy Deeney, and Roberto Di Matteo. So go to patreon.com/GrahamHunter. Do it now, please.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.